Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Ana Mateo presents a special holiday words and their stories from many years ago with former VOA announcer Morris Joyce. Later, Steve Ember brings us one part in an ongoing series about America's history. But first, the Higher Education Report.
United States Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos moved to make several policy changes affecting American higher education in 2018. This included reversals in court, some criticism, and also several new policies. DeVos's move in 2017 to withdraw guidance for colleges and universities given by the administration of former President Barack Obama has faced criticism. The guidance dealt with what colleges and universities should do about accusations of sexual assault. In January 2018, three activist groups took legal action against the department. The groups said withdrawing the guidelines hurt protections guaranteed by the 1972 federal law known as Title IX. Title IX bars discrimination based on sex at American colleges and universities, as well as at elementary and secondary schools. Schools that receive federal money are required to offer a clear way for students and employees to report sexual assault. They also must hold fair, open investigations. In 2011, the Obama administration added guidance about how to deal with sexual violence accusations. Some rights groups praised the new rules at the time. However, the Education Department withdrew the Obama administration rules in September 2017. It said they failed to provide fairness to both the accuser and the accused.
Sky Perryman is with Democracy Forward. Her group, the National Women's Law Center, and the National Center for Youth Law brought the action against the Department of Education. Perryman told VOA that DeVos's withdrawal of the 2011 guidelines would have a bad effect on those who might experience sexual violence. Individuals who've experienced sexual violence and sexual assault on campuses have been chilled in their ability to bring claims because they do not believe that the system will protect them, she said. In November, DeVos released new proposed rules for investigating sexual wrongdoing at colleges and universities. The new plan must go through a 60-day public comment process before it can be finalized. It includes some changes sought by some groups. For example, one of the new guidelines would give accused students the chance to ask their accusers questions. In a statement, DeVos said, "We can and must condemn sexual violence and punish those who perpetrate it, while ensuring a fair grievance process." Under the proposed rules, schools would only be required to investigate accusations if the reported incidents happened on areas overseen by the schools. The earlier guidelines had required schools to investigate all accusations wherever they were reported to have taken place. Some rights groups, like the American Civil Liberties Union, have said on Twitter that the proposed rules are unfair to the accuser. The period for comment on the new rules ends in January.
In early March, former Corinthian College's students made the claim that the education department unfairly used information about how much money they earn. The students said the agency used information from the Social Security Department to limit their student loan debt relief. Corinthian Colleges was a for-profit higher education company that operated several schools across the U.S. and Canada. In 2015, the U.S. government found evidence it was illegally misinforming its students. The education department has the ability to, in many cases, forgive student loan debt. Under former President Obama, the department paid $550 million to forgive student loans for tens of thousands of former Corinthian students. The department then made rules designed to clarify how students can get debt relief. The rules were opposed by many for-profit colleges and universities. The policy is known as borrower defense, and the changes were meant to go into effect in July 2017. But DeVos said the rule made forgiving loans too easy and was unfair to taxpayers. So she blocked it while attempting to create a new policy to replace it. In September 2018, U.S. District Judge Randolph Moss decided that DeVos's delay was unlawful. Some of DeVos's policy changes have not faced legal opposition. In September, the Education Department removed national median data from its online tool that helps students decide which college or university to attend. A median number is one in a series of numbers that represents the middle value.
In 2013, the Obama administration launched the website called College Scorecard. It is a database for important information on schools across the country, including yearly costs and average student debt. The Education Department removed national median numbers from the website this year. It said that it was unfair to compare all schools with that measure. However, even some supporters of Secretary DeVos and her efforts found the change in the college scorecard troubling. If you do not have anything to compare it to, you don't understand what's out there, said Daniel Elkins with the Enlisted Association of the National Guard of the United States. Then you have to compare multiple graphs, multiple charts, and try to figure out an average on your own, he added. The Associated Press reports that DeVos announced one more major policy proposal for schools of all levels on Tuesday. In 2014, the Obama administration urged schools not to suspend, remove, or report students involved in bad behavior to police, except in extreme cases. That guidance came after research showed black students were more than three times as likely as white students to be suspended or removed. However, a federal school safety commission has recommended changes to that policy in its final report. DeVos led the commission. She said that the federal government should not make one rule for all schools. The primary responsibility for the physical security of schools and the safety of their students naturally rests with states and local communities, DeVos said. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. This week, we have a special program for the holiday season. It is a show recorded many years ago by Morris Joyce. He worked as an announcer at the Voice of America and presented words and their stories, among other programs, in special English. Today, he tells about a popular personality at this time of year, Santa Claus. We hope you enjoy this blast from the past. And now, here is Morris Joyce.
Santa Claus is someone who will remain in the hearts of children forever. He is the make-believe person who brings toys and other gifts to children at Christmas. To grown-ups, he is a special symbol of goodwill and selfless giving. Santa Claus also has some other names: St. Nicholas, St. Nick, Kris Kringle, Peltznickel. Two of his names, Santa Claus and St. Nicholas, both come from the Dutch, who settled in New York long ago. The Dutch believed St. Nicholas gave gifts to children. They honored this kindly saint with a yearly festival on December 6th. The English-speaking people who live nearby greatly enjoyed Dutch festivals, and they brought the saint and the custom of giving gifts into their own celebration at Christmas time. The Dutch spoke the name St. Nicholas very fast. It sounded like Sinterklaas. And so, when the English said this word, it sounded like Santa Claus. West of New York in Pennsylvania, many German farmers had also heard of St. Nicholas, but they called him Peltznickel. This word came from Peltz, meaning fur, and nickel for Nicholas. And so to the Germans of Pennsylvania, St. Nicholas, or Peltznickel, was a man dressed in fur who came once a year with gifts for good children. Soon people began to feel that the love and kindness Peltznickel brought should be part of a celebration honoring the Christkindl, as the Germans called the Christ child. After a time, this became Kris Kringle. Later, Kris Kringle became another name for Santa Claus himself. Whatever he is called, he is still the same short, fat, jolly old man with a long beard, wearing a red suit with white fur. The picture of Santa Claus, as we see him, came from Thomas Nast. He was an American painter, born in Bavaria. He painted pictures for Christmas poems. Someone asked him to paint a picture of Santa Claus. Nast remembered when he was a little boy in southern Germany. Every Christmas, a fat old man gave toys and cakes to the children. So, when Nast painted the picture, his Santa Claus looked like the kindly old man of his childhood. And through the years, Nast's painting has remained as the most popular picture of Santa Claus. Santa can be seen almost everywhere in large American cities during the Christmas season. Some stand on street corners, asking for money to buy food and gifts for the needy. Others are found in stores and shopping centers. It is easy to find them by the long lines of children waiting to tell Santa what they want for Christmas.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, riding down Santa Claus.
And that is our special Words and Their Stories for Christmas. I'm Anna Mateo, wishing you and your loved ones a very happy holiday season.
Hang your stockings and say your prayers, 'cause Santa Claus comes tonight. Here comes Santa Claus.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. Today we tell the story of how a British attack on Fort McHenry in the port of Baltimore led to the Star-Spangled Banner, America's national anthem. In the summer of 1814, British forces attacked Washington, D.C. They burned the Capitol building, the White House, and other public buildings. Then they withdrew to their ships in the Chesapeake Bay. British General Robert Ross and Admiral George Cockburn led the attack on Washington. Next, they planned to attack Baltimore. But the people of Baltimore expected the attack and began to prepare for it. 50,000 of them built defenses around the city. The port of Baltimore was protected by Fort McHenry. The guns and cannon of the fort could prevent British ships from reaching the city. The British began with a land attack against Baltimore. General Ross, Admiral Cockburn, and about 4,000 British soldiers landed at North Point, a finger of land reaching into the Chesapeake Bay. From North Point, it was a march of about 22 kilometers to Baltimore. The British began marching at about 7 in the morning. General Ross and Admiral Cockburn stopped their men after an hour. The two commanders and several of their officers rode to a nearby farmhouse and forced the family living there to give them breakfast. When the British officers finished eating, the farmer asked General Ross where the British were going. "To Baltimore," he answered. The farmer told Ross that he might have some difficulty getting there because of the city's defenses. But the British general replied, "I will eat supper in Baltimore or in hell." When they returned to the march, Ross and Cockburn moved far in front of the British forces. A group of several hundred Americans opened fire on the British officers. Ross was hit. He died soon afterward. The Americans retreated, but they slowed the progress of the British soldiers. It was late the next day before the British force arrived to face the Army of Americans near Baltimore. The Americans were on high ground and had about 100 cannon to fire down on the British. The British commander ordered his men to rest for the night. He sent a message to the British warships to attack the city with guns and mortars. Such an attack, he felt, might cause the Americans to fall back. But the British ships had already been firing at Fort McHenry since early morning. the British guns were more powerful than those of the fort. The strength of their guns let the ships fire from so far away that the American guns could not hit them. Shells and bombs from British mortars fell like rain over Fort McHenry, but few Americans in the fort were hurt or killed. Most of the rockets and shells exploded in the air or missed. Many of them failed to explode. At the center of the fort flew a large American flag. The flag could be seen by the soldiers defending the city and by the British warships. The flag was also seen by a young American named Francis Scott Key. Key was a lawyer who had once thought of a life of religious work. He was also a poet and writer. He opposed war, but he loved his country and joined the army in Washington to help defend it. When the British withdrew from Washington, they took an American doctor named William Beans with them. Francis Scott Key knew the doctor and asked President Madison to request the British commander to release him. President Madison wrote the request, and Key agreed to carry it to Admiral Cockburn. Key also carried letters from wounded British soldiers in American hospitals. In one of the letters, a British soldier told of the excellent medical care he was being given. Cockburn agreed to free the doctor after he read the reports that his wounded men were receiving good medical care. But Cockburn would not permit the doctor or Key or a man who came with him to return to land until after the attack. So Francis Scott Key watched from a British warship as the shells and rockets fell on Fort McHenry. Years later, he said, "I saw the flag of my country waving over a city, the strength and pride of my native state, a city devoted to plunder and desolation by its assailants. I witnessed the preparation for its assaults. I saw the array of its enemies as they advanced to the attack. I heard the sound of battle. The noise of the conflict fell upon my listening ear and told me that the brave and the free had met the invaders." All through the rainy day, the attack continued. Dr. Beans, watching with Key, had difficulty seeing the flag. He kept asking if the stars and stripes still flew above the fort. Until dark, Key could still see it. After that, he could only hope. Britain tried to land another force of men near the fort, but the Americans heard the boats and fired at them. The landing failed. Shells and rockets continued to rain down on Fort McHenry. At times, the fort's cannon answered. That told Key that the Americans had not surrendered. The British troops east of Baltimore spent most of the night trying to keep dry. Commanders could not decide if they should attack or retreat. Finally, orders came from the admiral: withdraw to your ships. A land attack against Baltimore's defenses would not be attempted. At first light of morning, British shells were still bursting in the air over the fort. The flag had holes in it from the British shells, but it still flew. The British shelling stopped at 7 o'clock. Key took an old letter from his pocket, and on it he wrote a poem about what he had seen. Oh, say, can you see by the dawn's early light what so proudly we hailed at the twilight's last gleaming, whose broad stripes and bright stars through the perilous fight, or the ramparts we watched were so gallantly streaming, and the rockets' red glare, the bombs bursting in air, gave proof through the night that our flag was still there. Oh, say, does that star-spangled banner yet wave? Or the land of the free and the home of the brave? Americans sang these words and remembered the attack on Fort McHenry. Then, in 1931, Congress made the Star-Spangled Banner the national anthem of the United States. The unsuccessful British attack on Baltimore was followed by news that Britain had also suffered a defeat to the North. British General George Prevost had led 11,000 soldiers south from Montreal to New York. At Plattsburgh, on the western shore of Lake Champlain, his army was opposed by fewer than 4,000 Americans. General Prevost believed he needed to get control of the lake before moving against the American defenders. He requested the support of 4 British ships and about 10 gunboats. A similar-sized group of American ships also entered the lake. In a fierce battle, the American naval force sank the British ships. The Army decided not to attack without naval support. The 11,000 British soldiers turned around and marched back to Montreal. By the time of these battles, the United States and Britain had already agreed to discuss peace. The peace talks began in the summer at Ghent in Belgium. At first, the British were in no hurry to sign a peace treaty. They believed their forces would be able to capture parts of the United States. Britain demanded as a condition for peace that the United States give large areas of its northwest to the Indians. It also said America must give Canada other areas along the border. And Britain would not promise to stop seizing American sailors and putting them in the British Navy. But British policy at the peace talks changed after the battles of Baltimore and Plattsburgh.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
This is VOA.